You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. This is Latin America Week at Brookings. We've had an event this morning on Mexico. I'm delighted to have this event now. And tomorrow, in partnership with the Atlantic Council and a number of other partners, we're hosting an event. We're hosting Susan Rice to discuss President Obama's upcoming trip to Cuba. There's an awful lot going on in U.S.-Latin America relations and in Latin America itself, and we're delighted to be part of that. It's a pleasure today to welcome Ambassador Kevin Whitaker to Brookings. I was saying to him just in the green room that I'm feeling slightly bad for asking him to leave a relatively well-governed country to come to the fragile state of D.C., but that's the way it goes. Diplomacy is a contact sport, and it's good to have you here to talk about your work. Kevin Whitaker was confirmed by the Senate in April of 2014 as ambassador to Colombia. Before that, he had been the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South America in the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs. Unlike a number of ambassadors in high-profile places, he is a career civil servant, served in the U.K., Jamaica, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Venezuela as Deputy Chief of Mission. He'd been in the Office of Cuban Affairs. He's been Deputy Executive Secretary and Director of the Office of Andean Affairs, so hugely knowledgeable about the region and the issues and U.S.-Colombia and U.S.-Latin America relations, and in 2005 was awarded the Secretary's Award for Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy. What's, I think, really notable is that his tenure, I'm not going to posit causality, though you can take it, his tenure has coincided with really important advances in the peace process in Colombia. This is an impending peace, a long-fought peace, but nevertheless real progress in the past period, and I think illustrates the positive dimensions of U.S. engagement in internal conflict. We spend a lot of time talking about, oh, we failed in Iraq and we failed here. But actually, there's a huge track record of successes in other parts of the world, and Colombia is going to become one of the more important. It also, I think, illustrates, and I suspect Kevin will talk about this, the interaction between American power on the one hand, American diplomacy on the one hand, and a whole host of other actors that are involved in the peace process. And we tend to obsess in Washington about the role we play. But of course, there are lots of forces that work towards a peace process, and I'd be keen to hear about that. President Santos has indicated that once Colombia signs the peace agreement, they're going to be ready to start contributing peacekeeping forces, et cetera. And it's a theme we've been developing here that Latin America, as it stabilizes, as it has stabilized over the last couple of decades, is increasingly contributing in a positive way to international order and international stability. And I think the transition of Colombia from a large, major, enduring civil war and source of other forms of violence to potentially a contributor to international order is a really striking development on the international stage. So we're going to be extremely interested to hear what you have to say about the situation in Colombia and U.S.-Colombia relations and the peace process, and I suspect you'll have a very engaged audience. And thank you all for making it here despite Metro's best efforts to keep you away. So following Ambassador Whitaker's remarks, Harold Trincunos, who is a senior fellow and directs our Latin America work, is going to moderate the conversation, but will very quickly involve all of you. So thank you very much for being here. Over to you.
Okay. Many thanks. I just wanted to make three points just at the start here, and I realize we have a lot of people in the room who are very knowledgeable about Colombia, and so I won't bore you with, you know, the basics. So three quick points. First off, the post-accord, and there will be an accord, the post-accord is going to be fabulously expensive. And Colombia is confronting it at a time when it's under rather significant budget pressures. When I got to Colombia, the dollar value of the Colombian budget was about $94 billion. And that was 18 months ago, 19 months ago. The dollar value of the Colombian budget now is about $64 billion, and that's merely because of the drop in the value of the peso. There's a lot of debate about how much the accord will cost or how much accord implementation will cost. Suffice to say, it will be tens of billions of dollars, and that money has to come from somewhere. Secondly, there are endgame challenges. This ride to the finish is not going to be like landing at National Airport. There's going to be turbulence. There already has been turbulence. And there's three things in particular that I'll mention and the broader implications that they have, in my view. First off, on DDR, where the FARC will go to, what conditions they will go to these sites, and when they will go there, when they will actually give up their arms. And the challenge that's embedded in that is that the FARC is strategically defeated. The FARC does not have the capacity to overthrow the government of Colombia. And that, you know, when Pastrana was president, but 16 years ago, let's put it that way, 16 years ago, a majority of Colombians believed for some time that a military overthrow of the government was possible. And that's no longer the case. So it's strategically defeated, but it feels like its views need to be taken into account. And so now when you have the Congress making decisions about where these concentration zones will be and the conditions under which they'll take place, the FARC objects dramatically to that. Secondly, transitional justice. This is a huge issue. It's very difficult to manage. And you know, the problem here, the embedded strategic problem, it seems to me, is this is the first significant conflict which is being resolved after the passage of the Treaty of Rome. And so the amnesty provisions which characterize end of conflict throughout the region previously no longer exist. That can't be done. Finally, President Santos has agreed that there needs to be some sort of public consultation. It's meant to be a plebiscite. There's a lot of details that's associated with that. And the challenge here is that the war, ending the war is a positive thing, and we all recognize that. And for a lot of Colombians, it doesn't affect their day-to-day life. And you see this playing out in terms of public opinion. Do people think a peace process is a good idea? Yes. Are they willing to finance it or agree to lessen conditions of detention for FARC members who are found to have violated law? The answer to that question is consistently no. You get very high percentages of Colombians saying no. So there are three challenges embedded. The final point that I'll make is just, and we, you know, any of these we can play out, but I just touch on briefly, the accord implementation will be hard. There is a remarkable readiness for peace on the part of the institutions of government. Rafael Pardo has his Ministry of Post-Conflict. They're looking at post-conflict issues in a rigorous and significant and serious way. They are coordinating with the international community, as they should be doing now. Colombian Reintegration Agency, which is the agency which is charged with dealing with demobilized combatants, is a state-of-the-art institution which has the capacity now to handle the anticipated flow of former combatants. So they're ready. And I think we should be ready as well. And President Obama's decision to request additional funds in FY17, I think, was a very important expression of our commitment in that regard. I hope that we can be there for them. I think it's important that we be there for them going forward in this post-accord period. It's great that the president has agreed that the executive will ask for that. It is our responsibility to make the case to Congress as to the merits here, and we'll attempt to do so. So just to begin with a few additional introductory comments.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. That was a great overview of where we stand today. And I think I'd like to pivot off some of your comments to follow up a little bit on this issue of the post-accord environment. I mean, historically, Colombia has actually been fairly good about negotiating agreements during this last 50 or 60 years, but there's just over and over again, there's been an issue at the implementation stage. I mean, accords have been reached, even leading to the reform of the Constitution, as you recall, back in the whole process taking place in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was good to hear that your assessment of the implementation side of things, which is one of the traditional weaknesses, is good. What about the issue of spoilers, both sort of within the process and there's people that are still outside the process, like the ELN, for example, and other organizations involved?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, in terms of spoilers, I think you put your finger on the most significant one, which is the ELN. Obviously, it would be far superior to conclude an agreement with the ELN more or less at the same time, on the same terms as the FARC. I think the government is continuing to push on that rock. The chances that will happen in the same time frame as the FARC, I think, is very small. And so the import of that is if folks who are now in the FARC for any reason, for ideological reasons, for criminal reasons, because ELN is as involved in criminal activities as the FARC, if for any reason they seek to continue their activities, there's a natural outlet for them. So that is a potential weakness. The other, I don't know if I could call it a spoiler, but I think that the making sure that the Colombian people are fully on board with this and are willing to understand the nature of the challenge that confronts us, a financial challenge, it's a kind of a psychosocial challenge too. There needs to be a knitting together of society. And of course, that's the easiest thing in the world to say, and it's something that is very hard to do as a practical matter and will take years to do. That, to me, seems to be one of the more significant challenges that they face.
No, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. And one of the other things, just to pick up on one of your early points about the role of the United States and Colombia played in partnership in trying to address this issue. Obviously, the U.S. has played an important role, but Colombia's always put up a larger part of the resources to implement things like Plan Colombia and the other parts of the strategy of the Colombian government to try to bring this conflict to a conclusion. Obviously, I thought it was a very striking figure. You gave a reduction in dollar value by one-third of the Colombian budget as they go into the post-peace accord environment. What role do you see for the U.S. in terms of assistance? I mean, the U.S. has played a significant role in the past. How do you see that shifting in the future going forward?
And so we've done a fair amount of thinking about this. And I just knowing that we have some folks here who are very knowledgeable, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail quickly than I might do otherwise. The first thing is, as you say, Plan Colombia, our contribution to Plan Colombia is probably about 4 or 5% of the total value. And that 4 or 5% amounts to $10 billion. So it's not an inconsiderable amount of money, but it's only 4 or 5% of the total. The vast majority of the financial resources for Plan Colombia came from Colombians. We are now running at about $300 million a year in aid, which is generous, and we're grateful for that. What we're looking for is a plus-up in four areas where we believe that our abilities, our background, our knowledge in Colombia permits us the chance to make a significant difference. So first, on the USAID side, USAID is already working on reintegration of former combatants, on victims, on land reform, on land restitution. All of those are critical to the post-conflict. We need to continue to be involved on counter-narcotics front. The new narcotics numbers came out. They were not good. And this just underlines the importance of us continuing to be involved on this front, and we hope to do so. The third area that I think we need to be involved in is continued support on military financing. I travel a lot around Colombia, and one of the things I go to places where American ambassadors have never been or haven't been for many decades because of the changed security environment. And one of the things I always ask to folks when I go to them, say, look, hasn't been an American ambassador here probably ever. I don't know if there'll ever be one again. What's the one thing you want me to learn? What's the one thing you want me to take away? And a remarkable percentage of the time, they will say, roads. We need roads. We need roads to get our product to market. When the kid gets sick, you can take him to the health clinic. As a practical matter, in the conflicted municipalities, I don't know that private industry is going to want to be involved there. And to me, it seems logical that the military, the Colombian military, will be asked to pick up that burden. They have substantial engineering capacities. We can help them in that area. We can help them with planning. We can help them through the Corps of Engineers. We can help them think through the nature of the challenge. And the final area, which is obviously very important, is demining. Colombia is the second most mined country in the world after Afghanistan. The Colombians estimate it'll cost $350 million to demine, to make Colombia mine impact free. That's a lot of money. We have already pledged to seek about $20 million which is a very generous contribution if we're able to make that happen. And it's just a fraction of what's required. So it's for that reason that President Obama announced a global demining fund for Colombia, which we're working with the Norwegians, and we hope that can be successful.
I want to pick up on one or two of your points here and ask you about the counter-narcotics area. I mean, obviously, we have a long-standing relationship with the Colombians on this issue. As you said, the latest numbers aren't great. But there's also been a shift in emphasis under the Santos administration, a new approach, a new strategy, in a sense, for how to deal with the issue of illicit drugs in Colombia. How is U.S. thinking adapting to that? How are you engaging that new approach as Santos sort of pivots towards more of a public health approach? I mean, the top line item is the decision to kind of end aerial fumigation and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, it's you know, there's a lot there. I think that the Colombians want to focus very much on, as they say, they don't want to go after the weakest link. They don't want to go after the coca farmers or the people who are transporting cocaine. And not only do we now agree with that, we've always agreed with that. The approach that we take through DEA is to go after networks. And we have a counter-network strategy. We have successfully, with the Colombians, and this is really Colombian achievements, but the Medellin cartel, the Cali cartel, the Norte de Valle cartel, one after another have been knocked down. The Bacrim, the criminal bands who are now some of the main players in the business, the average time in office, if you will, of a Bacrim head is less than 14 months because of the counter network effort that we're making. And so we'll continue to do that. I think we agree on the point about going after networks. Another component that has to be there is eradication. And the elimination of aerial eradication was important, but I think it's also important to note two things. One is this was not a discretionary decision by the Colombian government. They were forced by a court ruling and believed in order to comply with the court ruling, they needed to do away with it. And so we have to respect that analysis. We have to respect the courts in that regard. Secondly, at the time eradication was ended in October of 15, 60% of existing coca was in areas we couldn't spray anyway. Border regions, indigenous reserves, national parks. There's a reason for that, obviously. The coca was migrating to areas that we couldn't spray. But the fact is, those are areas we couldn't spray. The final component, so what they need to do now is engage more on the manual eradication side. The government is absolutely committed to ensuring that manual eradication is consensual and voluntary. That, as a practical matter, is, I understand the logic of it, I support the logic of it, and as a practical matter, is extraordinarily difficult to do because what it involves as a practical matter is going into little comarcas and talking to the coca farmers and negotiating deals with them on a one-off basis. If there were a way to do this at a more global level, because talking to one campesino at a time when there are 100,000 coca-growing families is a major activity. If there were a way to do it at a higher level, that would be superior. The final piece is interdiction. And, you know, I'm actually, we need to interdict onshore and we need to interdict offshore. Having said that, when the Colombians interdict offshore on the high seas, all of the damage associated with the trade has already occurred. The environmental devastation, the money has gone already. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing to interdict on the high seas, but you're affecting the Mexican cartels when you do that, which is a good thing. But the damage has already been done in Colombia, and so the interdiction needs to take place internally as well. I think we have what we can work with here, but as you say, we're dealing with a dramatically changed situation.
And to what extent has the Colombian government really started to think about if they're going to move towards a policy of consensual manual eradication, the alternative development, alternative livelihoods piece, because that's something that, with the exception of one experiment that worked quite well but was shut down, they really don't have a great track record on. And to what extent is that factored into the post the post-peace accords? I know there's a discussion of rural development.
I mean, this is a critical component here. One of the reasons that we know that alternative development is hard is because we as the U.S. government have failed catastrophically at it. So we have that experience under our belt. But you need at least three things to make it work right. One is you need security, because without security, folks will be pressured to or will continue to grow coca. Secondly, you need another product and markets for that product. And third, you need infrastructure. The challenge, of course, is in the conflict municipalities, the 200 or so municipalities where you have coca or coca transport routes or FARC or some combination of the above. In many of those municipalities, you have none of the three, not security, not infrastructure, not markets. And so it's really a matter of sort of starting from the ground up on this. With our experience, we know what works and what doesn't, and we're committed to working with them on it. But let me give an example. We've had a terrific experience working with cacao. I was just up in Carmen de Bolivar in Monte de Maria, first American ambassador to visit there in forever. We have a cacao program that we've been working on there for 7 years. There's real products. They're exporting to Europe. It's a great story. And when you plant a cacao bush or whatever it is, tree, from that second until you get the first product is 2 years. And that 2 years has to be managed somehow. There need to be opportunities and income that's associated with something. So one of the things the government has talked about is stipends for those families. That's a model that could potentially work.
I just want to touch on two more quick things before we go to the audience. We want to have your participation in this conversation with Ambassador Whitaker. One issue that we were talking about before we walked into the room was, in comparison to some of other U.S. efforts to support the end to conflicts in other parts of the world, the role of Congress has really been critical here. Mm-hmm. We also know that the U.S. doesn't have a terrific track record of staying engaged in post-conflict. Mm-hmm. Is there something there that you can work with that you think will sustain the level of U.S. engagement in Colombia even after the peace accord is reached?
You know, I'm really grateful for that question. I'll mention the past and then go into the future. You know, there have been a series of articles in the Post and the Times. Politico had one about how we're the gang that can't shoot straight. We can't help a government in need. We've failed in Syria, and we've failed in Libya, we've failed in Africa. I make no comments on any of that because it's not my area. But the fact is, we can help a government in need, and we've done it right here and in Colombia. And I think it's really important to sort of think about in a rigorous way why we succeeded. And of course, thing one is Colombia is not like those places. And I freely admit that. Colombia is a unitary state. It has a high-quality military, which is responsive to civilian leadership. It doesn't have big racial divisions, although there are issues, of course, and I think that's important to note that. It doesn't have religious divisions. It doesn't have, the neighborhood is, for the most part, reasonably stable. It doesn't have a lot of the problems that some of the other countries may have. But there are things that we did right. And I think it's really important to capture that and be aware of that and seek to replicate it. Thing one in that regard is Plan Colombia was always viewed as a long-term project. The first Plan Colombia was 2 years. And the nature of these developments is if you pull off the Band-Aid after 6 weeks, you're not going to like what you see. They take time to mature and to work. The second part of this, why we were successful, is we brought in Congress from the very beginning. They insisted on being involved. So this was not an executive imposition and a policy. This was very much done in a shared manner. And I've worked on Colombia since 2008, and so I'm a veteran of a lot of these encounters. And it's hard work and it's difficult and we have disagreements. But at the end of the day, what we have now is we have a Congress that feels like this success is their success. And they're absolutely right. Without their engagement, without their involvement, we wouldn't be anywhere near the success we've had. And so that's another key takeaway. The third part is we have deep depth on Colombia. I mentioned I've been working on Colombia since 2008. And before that, I was in Venezuela, so I was in the neighborhood. Our recently departed left post, I should say, DEA regional director, Jay Bergman, was there for 9 years. My political counselor now, John McNamara, who some of you may know, he was a former Special Forces, so he served in the Special Forces in Colombia in the late 1990s. He came back and was a junior officer and worked in INL, and now he's the political counselor. That gives you a depth of knowledge and an understanding of the total situation, which is just, it can't be replicated, it can't be bought. So in going forward, I think we need to play on our contacts with Congress. I think we need to engage with Congress. I'm going up after this and in coming days going up and trying to explain what our vision is to Congress so that they continue to feel a part of this. And I'm sure that, my plan, which is incredibly brilliant from my perspective, is going to run into some heavy weather up there. But as Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face. So I'll work it that way.
Well, that actually, I'll reserve my other question on Colombia and its contributions to international security, though I do want to come back to that maybe towards the end, because I know that we've got a ton of people who want to ask questions and a very experienced audience. I'll take groups of three, I think. If I can take one all the way to the right, in the back row, and then here in the front. I think there was the gentleman with the red tie actually had a... Yeah, so over here. And
hey, Walt, how are you? Good to see you.
Ambassador Whitaker, Walter Earl from National Defense University. My question is regards the post-conflict and the armed forces. Colombia has a very large armed forces establishment. It's relatively expensive. Presumably, it needs to downsize if the conflict is really over. How do you see that transition? Will the armed forces be ready to downsize? Will there be a shift toward the police? Are the political forces? One would think intuitively that people would recognize the need to reduce budget costs, but are the political forces aligned to support a transformation? Thank you.
Thank you, and great example. Please ask short to the point questions and identify yourself and provide an institutional affiliation. Let's go to the young woman in the back and then maybe back here to the front row. Yes.
Okay. You said the back row, so I was confused.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Moira Burse. I work with Peace Brigades International. And I wanted to ask, you mentioned that the security situation has improved in many ways, and that's certainly true. I mean, homicide rates have gone down as one example. But one indicator that has not reduced and, in fact, has increased is the number of killings of human rights defenders, civil society leaders, land rights activists, and the like. In fact, in 2015, at least 63 of them were killed. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about what you know of the discussions at the negotiating table in terms of protection and the role of civil society leaders in building a more robust democracy and peace building, and also what the U.S. government is doing to address those concerns. Thank you.
And another quick question here, and then we'll come back to Ambassador.
Okay. Hi, Mr. Ambassador. To my right, I have the member of Congress from Colombia, Heriberto Arechea. And to my left, I've got Luis Olave, civil rights leader, activist in Colombia. And I think he wants to ask a question for you.
Gracias, buenos días. Señor embajador, estamos muy preocupados en Colombia porque no, en el proceso de paz, no se ha dado la representación de la población afro ni de la población indígena. Es un país, como usted lo mencionó, donde las regiones que el embajador comentaba que hay unas problemáticas son regiones donde predomina nuestra población. Adicional a esto, nosotros hemos venido defendiendo unos procesos políticos de representación política para la población afrocolombiana que fueron usurpados por grupos parapolíticos y hoy nos tienen acá pidiendo apoyo porque no hay protección para los que estamos defendiendo este caso, como el caso del representante Heriberto Arrechea y el caso mío. Entonces, no hay una celeridad en el gobierno colombiano frente a las problemáticas de la población afro, y quisiéramos ver de qué forma el gobierno de los Estados Unidos respalda y realza un poco la importancia que hemos nosotros defendido nuestros derechos y que han sido violados en el país.
¿Sí puedo dar una breve interpretación?
O si quieres dar un superdato.
Oh, just because we don't have translation available, just to briefly sum up the question, and hopefully I won't do the interpretation too much violence, but it's a question about the role of Afro-Colombians and indigenous Colombians in the peace process, and how are they represented, and how are their rights considered within the overall political process that's going forward in the country today, including a couple cases represented here today of impediments to the rights of elected officials. Right. From those regions of the country. Hope that was fair.
Okay. No, thank you. And so let me just in order. Actually, there is a widespread belief that the armed forces cannot downsize in the short run, and that security concerns need to remain at the forefront. Certainly, over time, there needs to be a transition to a greater internal security focus. And you know, there's been talk about whether the police would get bigger or whether the police would shift to another ministry, which seemed to be a hot rumor for a while and then sort of didn't take flight. But actually, it's an interesting comment when General Mejia, who you almost certainly know, took over. He announced the formation of a doctrinal review for the armies to look at what the doctrine should be and to institute a regular doctrinal review so that the Army would always be looking at its roles and missions. In one of the panels, and he had a public role out of this, one of the panels included Senator Claudia Lopez, who is about as far left as you can get in Colombia, and she's a Green Party, and she's on the political left. Her first comment on her panel was, anybody who thinks that the armed forces can be downsized in the climate of post-accord is dreaming. We need to maintain a strong armed forces to ensure that there's proper security conditions in place going forward. So I think there's actually a pretty clear-eyed view on the part of many Colombians of the need not to declare peace dividend and walk away from it. Of course, the countervailing point is the one that you mentioned, which is money is really tight now. And so, I know that the defense ministry has approached, as every ministry has been, about cutting its budget. But that's less about peace and dividend, more about sort of the overall situation. On human rights defenders, I appreciate the point. And of course, ensuring that human rights defenders and civil society leaders and labor leaders are properly protected, and that when their incidents occur, God forbid, when there are deaths, that these need to be quickly investigated and results need to be achieved. That is not the situation which has generally been the case in Colombia. As you may know, we've spent a fair amount of time and energy trying to improve their capacities in this regard, including through the Fiscalía, by supporting the development of a labor rights unit and a human rights unit, also a contextual analysis unit within the Fiscalía. I think these are important steps, and they haven't achieved the results in some that we would seek here. There's more that needs to be done. The FARC and the government at the table have a subcommission on protection issues. And the way that I conceive of this, and I'm probably oversimplifying, but I think in part this is about avoiding a Unión Patriótica kind of situation, where the Unión Patriótica came out into the legal domain 30 years ago, and many thousands of them were murdered. Obviously, if you're a member of the FARC, or if you're a guy like Iván Márquez, who actually was an elected member of the Unión Patriótica, that is foremost in your mind. I think it's also true, and it's also fair, to note that that was 30 years ago. And the political dynamic, the military dynamic, almost any factor involved there is different and distinct. So conceiving of it in the same way that, it'll happen the same way, I think that's I don't agree with that analysis. I think that analysis loses something. But there is a real, I repeat, there is a real issue there. That's why the government is involved in this commission, subcommission in Havana to talk about protection issues. So I better do this in English, yeah? So yeah, I'm going to do it in English, too bad. Okay. Look, the issue you raise is an important one. And I actually made the decision to raise this with President Santos the last time that I met with him, expressing my concern that the interests of Afro-Colombians and indigenous, if not taken into account, could represent at some level an obstacle. And it's an obstacle that can be avoided. Now, part of the government's response to this, not in my conversation with Santos, but separately, part of the government's response was that Afro-Colombians were included in the victims' circles which traveled to Havana. And I understand that, and there's a logic to that. But from our perspective, from my perspective, from the American government's perspective, more needs to be done. I gather that they intend to do this. There's meant to be an effort to have a more rigorous, consistent engagement with the community. I think that's the right thing to do. You know, the broader question that you ask about, you know, Afro-Colombian political protagonism, you know, I'm as frustrated as you are. Colombians represent 30, or Afro-Colombians represent 30% of the population, and the Colombian institution should look like Colombia, including with respect to race. That is our aspiration as a government. That is our aspiration as a nation for the United States, but also for Colombia. We'll continue to work with you to ensure that we keep that as a goal. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we have one, two, three already. Okay, so we'll start up here and then we'll work our way back.
Oh, thank you. Hey, Kim, great to see you. And thanks so much for your insights. It's really great to see you here as well. You opened your remarks by saying a little bit about the approval process for the peace negotiations. And President Uribe and other people have criticized President Santos for his willingness. They say he has staked his political legacy on the outcome of these negotiations. They criticize the approval process, saying he may go too far, and he's changing this. You're in a very objective position. Could you talk a little bit about this situation and how you view this moving forward? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we're here in the tan jacket, and then I think there was one in the back row as well.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Rodrigo Valderrama, Plantation International. With regard to the basically changes in after the interdiction, after the peace process, and the cocoa farmers, since I'm involved in that business too, is there going to be any price support other than what you mentioned afterwards to stabilize that market, and will the Corps of Engineers possibly help in constructing the roads to those areas, and will the cooperatives be involved, or will there be support for cooperatives?
Okay. And I think all the way in the back, there was right on the here on the aisle, right next to you.
Hi, welcome back to Washington, Ambassador. I'm Ginny Bouvier from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I have two questions that are somewhat related, but not necessarily. So the first regards the business sector and the attitudes among the business sector, both the U.S. business sector in Colombia and the Colombian business sector toward the peace process and toward kind of the future challenges in Colombia. And the second question is a more general question going back to your concern about bringing the Colombian people along. And it has to do with the role of culture and cultural workers and cultural heroes within Colombian culture. Is the embassy thinking in any way about ways to support this move toward a culture of peace that will be needed in the transitional process? Thanks.
Great question, Jenny. Turning back to you.
Okay. So on the plebiscite, you know, the plebiscite, President Santos had agreed had agreed from the very beginning that there needed to be some check with the Colombian people. There needed to be a Colombian popular approval of it. What they settled on at the end of the day is a plebiscite with a comparatively low voter participation level. I think 13% of the voters need to turn out in order for it to be valid. And this is different from the plebiscite, which is defined in the Constitution. They've arrived at this in a legal and constitutional manner. So there's no question about that from anybody's perspective. The question arises whether that's sufficient in terms of its participation level to ensure that, you know, the Colombian people will actually feel consulted. You know, my view is, and we'll see, but my view is that the issue is of such weight and moment and gravity that actually turnout will be a lot higher than that, and people will speak their minds. Uribe's concern is related but slightly different. His approach is that a matter of this gravity cannot be fully addressed merely by a plebiscite. There needs to be something more profound, like a constitutional assembly, a constitutional convention, to address this, which probably coincidentally is the position of the FARC. You know, the government has made the decision to go through the plebiscite route, and I think they're committed to it. I don't think that's going to change. Interestingly, there's the fiscal general came out just recently and said he didn't think that a plebiscite was even necessary, that the government could just decide and sign this agreement. So it's always hard to tell with Montenegro, who's a great partner of ours, who he's actually speaking for. He may have been speaking for himself in that regard. On the you know, the cocoa, cacao business, I have not heard anything said about price supports. Although, you know, clearly that's a mechanism that has been used elsewhere. For our part, what we've been able to do, and where we provided support, is we provide technical assistance to the farmers as they get into the business. And down in Tumaco, what we've done, in actually an Afro-Colombian area, is the Casa Lucre and the other purchasers were driven out by the FARC. They were extorted by the FARC and killed by the FARC, so they left. So we set up our own purchasing service in order to ensure that market existed down in that part of the country. And so that's the kind of thing that I could see us being involved in. Another thing that we're doing in this front is we've developed an association with the land-grant universities here in the United States. About 9 of them are involved now, in order to provide technical agricultural existence, like an agricultural extension service support to Colombian farmers. One of the institutions that's involved is Penn State, and Penn State has a state-of-the-art, as you probably know better than I do, has a state-of-the-art cacao investigation effort. And so Penn State is going to be working very closely with us as we move forward on this. You know, and then finally on the infrastructure, I actually can't imagine, although I think it would be great, but I can't imagine U.S. Forces building roads in Colombia. What I'm more thinking of is the Corps of Engineers bringing in their planning capacity. They have an enormous ability to sort of think about big projects and how to execute them and the mechanisms that you have to go through to think it through logically. And if you're dealing with a national size issue, that's the way you want to go about it. Business and the peace process. You know, here's what I'd say to you on this: is U.S. business is looking for opportunities. There's a theory that's being advanced by the Colombian government, especially the DNP, Simon Gaviria's outfit, that peace processes cause a secular increase in business opportunities and a durable bump in GNP. I hope he's right. That'd be great. And so U.S. businesses are looking for opportunities. U.S. businesses are also, frankly, concerned about some barriers to trade which have developed over time on scrappage for those cognoscente here, scrappage, ethanol, the pharma issue. I mean, these are all issues that, and alcohol in general, liquor. These are all issues which are of deep concern to our industry, and we've raised them at various levels. My point here is that clearing out those trade issues creates an even better environment for U.S. business or any international business to come in and work. Colombian business understands that that there's going to be interest in their engagement in this, doing social outreach and corporate social responsibility, hiring people. They also know, because the government has told them, that you know, there's going to be a financial implication to this as well, a tax implication. And you know, no, I don't know of any person or business that likes paying more taxes, except for Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said, "I like paying my taxes because it's the price of living in a civilized society." He's been dead for 100 years, though. So.
Good. I think we have time for maybe a couple more questions, including I'll take the moderator's privilege to pose one more to you, which is coming back to this issue of sort of the post-peace. I think one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is sort of Colombia's role in the region and in the world. Colombia, for very obvious reasons, has looked inward a good deal to try to address its own problems. Now, as it sort of emerges from that conflict and looks abroad, I mean, there's discussions of Colombia's contributions to security in Central America. There was some discussion at the General Assembly about peacekeeping. What kind of conversation are Colombians having about that? The Colombians that focus on those issues of where Colombia stands in the world. And in the interest of time, let's just pile on a couple more questions, two more, and then we'll give you the last word.
Okay.
Here. Okay. I think here, I'm sorry, somebody's been very patient from the Congressional Research Service. And then we'll come here to this front. Or close to the front.
Yes, Congressional Research Service, June Beidle. I may have this wrong, but I understood last week that the CD, the Democratic Center Party, Uribe's party, dropped their objection to the concentration zones, and that's how that legislation passed the Congress. Is that true, and why did that happen, or how did that happen?
Hi, how are you? I am Paola. I am a George Washington student, and also I'm from Colombia. And my question is with regards to the growing fear of having the FARC conduct politics with guns, and the government really not having a good answer for that. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, and what can be done to prevent this from happening if the process goes through.
Thank you. So Colombia and the region, Colombia sharing its capacity with the region, I think is, and more broadly, I think is a really important question. Actually, through Bill Brownfield's INL, we have worked, we have 283 discrete activities in which the Colombian Armed Forces is providing, and the Fiscalía is providing support in Central America and Mexico. That's just in this coming year. So, you know, there is a real giving back that is taking place, and the reason that we're all here is there's a chief of missions conference going on. So I talked to my colleagues from Central America. It's greatly appreciated by the security forces in Central America. You know, I actually think that it can go beyond that. And, you know, I'll mention a couple of ways. You noted there was discussion at the UN. Actually, what Colombia agreed to do was provide, once there's peace, provide two battalions of peacekeepers. I think that's a great activity for the Colombians to be involved in. I also think that, and this is actually on my way up here, I was actually at spring training, but after that I went to SOCOM and talked to General Botel and his team, and I actually believe that one of the highest speed parts of the Colombian military as a whole is their SOF, is their special forces. And I also know, and we have some people who are real experts here, so I will be prepared to be corrected, but as high speed as they are, I figure if they don't continue to exercise themselves, then you know that capacity will fall off, and you'll lose people, and you know you'll lose capacity. It seems to me using that Colombian soft capability more broadly in the world is a great way that Colombia can give back to the world. They are. I've had many people know, including General Votel, and I'll take his name in vain here, that you know they're not. They are peers of some of the best special forces in the world. And so let's use that. Let's find that opportunity for them to continue to give back. And I know there's capacity to do that. My understanding as well is the Centro Democrático dropped its, or they decided to vote for the bill on the creation of these DTs, these dispositivos en terrenos, which is the concentration zones. I think one thing that's important to note is, given the number of seats that they have, they could have voted against it and would have passed anyway. But you raise a legitimate question why they decided to vote for it. This is one of those things that I don't know the answer to, so I'm not gonna guess, but I just don't know. But it's a reasonable question. Look, when the FARC appeared in La Guajira, armed, it created this notion of proselitismo armado, which is actually a very old story. It goes back 30 and 40 and 50 years in Colombia, which is why you had such a sharp reaction to it. I agree with Cristo, Minister Mateo Cristo, who called it una torpeza infinita. It was just infinitely clumsy and not very smart on their part. I hope they've learned a lesson from that, because look, at the end of the day, what this is about and why this is so positive and good, it's about eliminating the use of violence and arms from the political arena forever. And so by taking actions like this, they're sending a signal that they don't understand that. And they need to understand that, because it's really important that this succeed and that they have a chance to sell their product in the marketplace of ideas, making arguments and trying to convince people to vote for their proposition. So that's the answer at the end of the day.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, thank you for a fascinating conversation on Colombia and on U.S. relations with a very important partner. And I really appreciate you joining us today. Please join me in thanking Ambassador Whitaker.
So that was fun.